Final reflexes. So for the spinal reflexes lecture, we're going to look at the definition of a reflex. What is a reflex? What are the types of reflexes? We are going to identify the landmarks for reflexes and look at the scale in which we assess reflexes. Does this reflex talk about something that's a lower motor neuron lesion in nature, or is it talking about something that's an upper motor neuron in nature? We're also going to look at the basic circuitry for the myotactic reflex. We did this already, but we're going to review it again. We're going to look at the modulation of the myotactic reflex and how that affects our reflex. We're going to describe the opposition of the myotactic reflex by the inverse myotactic reflex, which we would have also covered, and you will see that. This is just going to be a review, this particular aspect. We're going to look at the flexion and the flexion cross extension reflex, and we're going to explain abnormal and normal plantar reflexes. Then we're going to explain the neurological basics for areflexia or hyporeflexia, and I'm sure you will have, you know the neurological base already. Let me move this. All right, so injury, it says corticobulbar, but that should be corticospinal. Same thing. It's going to give you the same answer. So injury to the corticospinal fibers will cause which of the following? Or injury to the corticospinal tract will cause which of the following? Okay, so this question is basically assessing your understanding of the scale for reflex testing, and a review of the material would have given you that basic understanding. So reflexes can be measured on a scale from 0 to 4. So someone who has injury to the cortical bulb or your corticospinal fibers, now your corticospinal fibers, as we have seen, are those upper motor neuron fibers descending from the cortex that will have influence on your alpha motor neuron. So if we injure the corticospinal fibers, what type of syndrome are we going to see? Will we see an upper motor motor neuron syndrome or a lower motor neuron syndrome? We're going to see an upper motor neuron syndrome. So what this question is asking you to do is to match your motor neuron syndrome with your reflex findings. And you should have, right, 62% of you were able to get that correct. You should have been able to choose +4, which is associated with upper motor neuron lesions. And as we go through the lecture, we will actually cover that material. So your reflexes are predictable, stereotyped responses to a specific stimulus. They're predictable, a stereotyped response for a specific stimulus. So for example, if I take the patella hammer and I hit your patella tendon, what should I see? What would be the stereotyped response in a patient who does not have a deficit? You should see extension, all right? You should see extension in that patient. So that's what your reflexes are. So stereotype response. And as budding physicians, it's important for you to, of course, know how to do the reflex, but it's also equally important for you to know what you should expect with that reflex. Also, you need to know each reflex, what level of the spinal cord it assesses, because that's going to help you to locate the lesion. Now, your reflexes can be monosynaptic or they can be polysynaptic. All right, so for monosynaptic reflexes, these are characterized by most of your deep tendon reflexes, where you have an afferent and an efferent limb that are directly connected. And we saw that when we were looking at our lecture on the innervation of the muscle fibers and the motor unit. Your polysynaptic reflexes, we have afferent and efferent limbs that are interconnected with more or with one or more interneurons. So when we have the involvement of interneurons, we're looking at our polysynaptic reflex. And some examples we have it here would be your papillary light reflex and your abdominal reflex. Anyone has done the small group for this week as yet? Yes, you did some reflex testing? All right, excellent. Good, we talked about the level of the spinal cord as it relates to reflex testing. So now we're just going to look at the level of the spinal cord for some reflexes and also some other important functions. So as it relates to respiration, we're going to be looking at our diaphragm, which is the principal muscle of inspiration. So as it relates to your respiratory effort, your diaphragm is going to be the principal muscle. And we know during quiet respiration, your diaphragm just relaxes, okay? So your diaphragm is going to be innervated by fibers coming from C3, C4, C5. As we know, C3, 4, 5 keeps the diaphragm alive, or whatever it is that you usually say. For shoulder adduction, we have our deltoid muscle, and that's going to be innervated from fibers that are coming from C5. Now, for elbow flexion, we have our biceps and our brachialis, all right? Now, that is going to be for our C5, C6 level of the spinal cord. And this is a reflex that you would have been doing since you were in term one, am I correct? When you did the MSK module, you would have done some reflex testing. So your biceps reflex, C5, C6. Now, when you do the bicep reflex, what is it that you expect to see? What should be seen? Flexion. Now, if you don't see flexion, does that mean that the patient has areflexia? So apart from flexion, what else you may see that can tell you that things are okay? Supination, what else? Twitching of the muscle, all right? So importantly, when you're doing the reflex testing, you must expose the muscle that you're actually assessing. So if you're doing the knee-jerk reflex, ideally, you should expose the patient's thighs, okay? So if you don't see the stereotyped response, at least you will see some response or twitching from the muscle. Is that clear? So when you do your OSCE, it's important that you demonstrate that you have this knowledge, okay? So patient, you're going to do a patient's biceps reflex, and they're wearing a jacket like me. Ideally, you should ask that patient to remove the jacket so that you can be able to see what's going on with that muscle, okay? For wrist extension, we have C6, C7. For elbow extension, we have our triceps reflex. And the ones that we have grayed out, those are actually the reflexes that are pertinent. So for elbow extension, we have our triceps reflex, and that's C6 to C8. Some other places might say C7, C8, so that's going to look at your triceps. If you have a patient and you do the biceps reflex and there is areflexia, you would want to investigate that region a little bit more to figure out if that patient has a lower motor neuron syndrome. For thigh adduction, we have L2 to L4. And for knee extension, which is our quadriceps reflex or knee-jerk reflex, we have L3 to L4. For your ankle plantar reflex, or your gastrocnemius reflex, if you want to call it that, we have S1 and S2. So if you want to draw a stick man to help you to remember where these reflexes are, what level of the spinal cord is associated with what reflex, we can use this diagram. So your scale for reflex testing. If you do reflex testing and there is no response, that patient has areflexia, which is associated with what type of lesions? Lower motor neuron lesion. So if you go to the lab, for those of you who have not been, and you do reflex testing on a patient and there is no reflex, does that mean that the patient has areflexia and a lower motor neuron lesion? Most likely not. It may mean that your technique is a little bit off and you need some more practice, all right? So in the lab, the main aim is for you to know what is it that you need to do or how to carry out the technique. And then as you practice it, you will be able to own that skill and be able to see the reflexes that are necessary. Then there may be a plus one reflex. So it's somewhat diminished. And for you to assess if a reflex is diminished, it's actually very important for you to know what normal looks like. But for different people, normal may be a little bit variant. Because I did some reflexes on some students who have some really, you know, brisk reflex. But it wasn't that they were hyper-reflexic. Okay, so as you continue to practice and as you're exposed to clinical settings with patients who actually have these type of lesions, you will be able to make the differentiation. But apart from that, of course, you don't only look at the reflex. You're going to also look at the entire picture. You're going to take also the clinical history into consideration as you try to figure out what's going on with the patient and where the lesion is. Now, your plus two or your two plus, that would be average or normal. So if you're reporting on someone's reflex and you say it's plus two or two plus, it's normal. That's normal reflexes. So anything below two is abnormal, and anything above two is also abnormal. Below two would be associated with lower motor neuron lesions, and above two will be associated with upper motor neuron lesions. Now we're seeing here that three plus is brisker than average, and in some patients it may be high normal. It depends, all right? So you have to assess the situation. But plus four definitely is very, very brisk. And these are the patients that you definitely do not want to stand in front of them when you're doing the knee-jerk reflex. And it's also we can also see clonus in these patients. So plus four usually means hyperreflexia with clonus. So as I said before, your responses may be, it's going to vary depending on the patient, depending on the situation. And what you need to do is assess the entire patient. So if you assess the patient and you notice that this is generally what their reflexes is like, it may be that they just have a high normal reflex, okay, in terms of the briskness of it. Also, the patient, if they're not relaxed, if they're not, and if they're focusing intently on what you're doing, you may actually not see a reflex. So it's important to distract the patient, ask them a question, how was your day, or count backwards, or something like that, so that you can be able to assess the patient's reflex well. Now, I want a volunteer. Who is going to come? Any volunteer? We're going to do some reflex testing. Oh, I see. Okay, someone is coming there. Could you bring a chair when you're coming, please? Could you bring a chair? Thank you. You could put it right here. That's fine. All right, you may have a seat. Okay, so we're going to do reflex testing. And of course, if we do reflex testing, we need to have a reflex hammer. Not so? So which one of these hammers might be the most useful for my adult patient? What do you think about this hammer? You can hold it. It's a little puny. I agree. So this is not necessary. It's a reflex hammer. It could work, but as it relates to this adult patient, for all of these hammers that I have, this is not the best reflex hammer. So what I'm going to do, toss it. Right. So this is a good reflex hammer, but it's small. All right. This is a pediatric reflex hammer. So again, he's an adult. We don't want it. He says we're getting somewhere. Why do you think so? All right, so this is a good hammer. It has a head that's relatively heavy, but it's too light here, okay? It's not good. Right, So this hammer is actually, this hammer can be used for reflex testing in an adult. Okay, so it's actually appropriate. But between the two of them, yes, this is actually the best hammer for reflex testing in an adult. Okay? I'm not saying that if you have those hammers that you should toss them. Please do not do that. You need it for your OSCE. Okay? I'm just making the point that this would be the best reflex hammer. It has a very heavy head, and the base, the handle, even though it looks heavy, it's actually very light. So he agrees. Okay, so this would be the most appropriate hammer to do reflex testing in an adult patient. So if we want to do the biceps reflex, all right, and your biceps reflex, as we know, C5, C6, we're going to see, we should see some flexion there. We want to make sure that the muscle is exposed, so his biceps is exposed, and we want to make sure that we position the patient's arm appropriately. So of course, you know that you can, there are two ways that you can do it, either with supporting the patient's arm, or you can do it by actually putting the arm on the leg, slightly flexed, pronated. Okay? So what I want to do, I want to feel for the tendon. If you can't feel the tendon, you ask them to flex a bit. So just flex a bit. Flex. All right. So I feel that tendon. I'm going to press it with my finger. And the reason why this is the only reflex you keep your finger on it is because the tendon is deep. So if I just take this hammer and hit, I'm not necessarily going to get to the tendon. Okay? So I put my finger on it and I hit my finger to transmit the impulse to the tendon. Yeah? And it's a nice light swing. So even though this is a reflex hammer, you should not be pounding. Okay? So you swing. It's a wrist movement, but you'll get it in time. Okay? So don't worry about it too much. So that would be your biceps reflex. Now your brachioradialis reflex, which you would have done in the lab also, it assesses same C5, C6. If you have to assess C5, C6 in the patient, you can choose to do the biceps or the brachioradialis, unless you're asked to do either one of the two of them. For your triceps reflex now, so just relax. Again, you feel for the tendon, so you must always feel for the tendon, okay? You feel for the tendon, muscle is exposed, and I'm going to, okay. So what's the problem here? All right, so he's waiting for it. So that's what I was saying. If your patient is paying too much attention to what you're doing, well, then you have a problem. For the triceps reflex, when you let go of the patient's hand, it should drop to the side. That means they must put all the weight on your hand. They must relax, okay? Ah, right. So that's your triceps reflex. And of course, you're going to be doing these reflexes bilaterally. For your knee-jerk reflex, okay, of course, ideally, we should ask him to take his pants off, but we're not going to do that, okay? Okay. So we're going to palpate for the tendon. Now, someone who has their leg fixed to the ground, you will not be able to see the knee-jerk reflex, all right, or the quadriceps reflex. So could you put this one out? Put this across. Just cross your legs. All right? So you can have them like that. You palpate the tendon. Do you like being up here? All right? So you try to distract them so that they don't focus on what you're doing. Okay? So that would be for your knee-jerk reflex. And of course, for the ankle-jerk reflex, we're not going to ask him to take off his shoes and all of that. But he needs to take off his shoes. He can do it while he's sitting, or we can have him kneel on the chair. So he takes off his shoes, takes off his socks. We want to expose the area. He has to expose his calf muscles. We palpate for the tendon, and then we hit the tendon. I've seen students palpate for the tendon and then hit their finger. The only time you hit your finger is when you're doing the biceps reflex. But you must always palpate for the tendon. Okay? All right, thank you very much. All right, so I need my hammer, so I must pick them up. So now that we've gone through the scales for the reflex testing, and we know the level for which, the spinal level for each reflex, let's look at the myotactic reflex, the basic circuitry. We did this already. So we said for the myotactic reflex, we are going to stretch the muscle. Yeah, so we're going to basically palpate the muscle, then hit it with the tendon, which actually causes the muscle to stretch. Now that information is going to be carried to your central nervous system via the 1A fibers, and we're seeing it's going through the dorsal horn, and it communicates directly with the alpha motor neuron of that muscle, which is going to result in contraction of that muscle. And we would have covered this in a previous lecture, so this is basically just review. Now, your reflexes are modulated. So as you hit the tendon stretch, the information goes via the 1A fiber to your to synapse with your alpha motor neuron and then cause contraction of the particular muscle. We see that there's also communication that's actually going to your central nervous system. So this is where we have our long loop reflex pathway. So this information goes to the central nervous system, and your central nervous system now has control over that reflex. That is why it's very important for you to kind of distract the patient so that they're not paying too much attention and suppressing that reflex. So modulation of your stretch reflex. So as we can see here, your 1A fiber synapses onto your alpha motor neuron, which is the lower motor neuron that communicates with the particular muscle fibers associated with the stretch. But as we can see, our corticospinal fiber also is synapsing onto that alpha motor neuron. So therefore, if I have an upper motor neuron syndrome where my corticospinal fibers are affected for some reason, I do not have this cortical influence onto the alpha motor neuron that is influencing this muscle. So therefore, when I test the reflex, it is going to be exaggerated because I don't have these cortical fibers influencing my alpha motor neurons. So this is why we see the hyperreflexia in patients who have upper motor neuron syndrome. Now your inverse myotactic reflex. We saw this when we discussed the function of the Golgi tendon organ. So as we know, our Golgi tendon organ is located towards the end of the muscle fibers, where it's going to be connected to the tendons. And when stretch is detected, our 1B fiber is going to relay that information to the central nervous system. And there, it communicates via an interneuron with or alpha motor neuron to give an inhibitory effect. So instead of contraction, now we're going to have relaxation. And this was what we said would happen if Dr. McKenzie tries to lift a 200-pound weight. Okay? So this would be our inverse myotactic reflex, and it's mediated by the Golgi tendon organ. And we basically went through the limb already. Now there's your flexion reflex, okay? So with a noxious stimuli, okay, let's say for example you decide to walk in the yard bare feet, okay? Something pricks you, you will not continue to step on it. You'll actually lift your legs away from it, okay? So there will be flexion away from that particular stimuli. You will withdraw. You will withdraw from that particular stimuli. So what we see here, pain fibers are coming in to the level of the spinal cord that's associated with the stimuli. So whether it's your hand or your lower limbs, it comes in. And it's going to communicate via an excitatory interneuron. So in the inverse myotactic reflex, we saw that we had an inhibitory interneuron here. In our flexion reflex, we see that we have an excitatory interneuron, And this excitatory interneuron is going to synapse onto the alpha motor neuron associated with that particular limb. And it's going to cause contraction, all right? So the patient removes their limb from that particular stimuli. And of course, it's ipsilateral in nature, as we're seeing everything is happening on the same side. But then we have our flexion cross extension reflex. So let's use the same example. You're walking in the yard, bare feet, something probably prick your feet. So you flex, let's say you feel the stimuli, the painful stimuli under your right leg. So you're going to lift your right leg up. But if your left leg is not fixed to the ground, if it's not extended, you're going to fall. Okay? So your flexion cross-extension reflex actually prevents you from falling in such instances. So, of course, you are going to excite your flexes. As we said, the red means excite. Okay, your black means you're going to inhibit. So you have the painful stimuli coming in from this side. So ipsilaterally, you're going to excite your flexes because you want to remove that limb from that stimuli. We see that fibers also are going to cross over and communicate via interneurons with the flexors and extensors on the contralateral side. So it's going to excite the extensors on the contralateral side so that you can actually maintain your balance and don't actually fall to the ground. Now your plantar response. Did you do this in the lab yesterday? For those of you who went. Huh? I see some people making up their faces. All right. So for the plantar response, you need the patient to remove their shoes and their socks, okay? And you're going to take your patella hammer, the end of it, or something else that's sharp, but not too sharp, of course, okay? And you are going to briskly make this pattern that we see here on the diagram. So from the sole of the feet, you're going to trace this pattern very briskly. And when that happens, you should see a characteristic response in patients who have upper motor neuron syndrome. And if they don't have an upper motor neuron syndrome, well, then you should also see a characteristic response. Now, if they have an upper motor neuron syndrome, we're going to see what's called the Babinski reflex, or what is called your extensor plantar reflex. It's important to note that this reflex is common in children before they can actually walk. But once they can walk, this reflex actually goes away. Now, what are your efferent fibers? So you have your afferent fibers, you have nociceptive stimuli. So the sharp object is actually that you're going to use to trace this pattern on the patient's, on the sole of the patient's feet. That is going to be your afferent limb. So we have A delta fibers and C fibers. And then that information goes to the central nervous system. And we are going to have a response via our efferent limbs, which would be your alpha motor neurons, the level of L5 and S1 of your central nervous system. So your normal response would be plantar flexion of the big toe, all right? For the extensor plantar response, we see dorsiflexion of the big toe, or what we call the great toe, and fanning of the other toes. And this would indicate an upper motor neuron lesion or a lesion to the corticospinal fibers anywhere along its track. Now, for hyporeflexia, it can be due to a lesion in many parts of our nervous system. It can be due to a lesion affecting the ventral horn, where we have the soma, or the cell bodies of our alpha motor neurons. Or it can be due to a lesion of our alpha motor neuron on its way to that particular muscle. So a few days ago, we talked about lesions that would cause demyelination, or lesions that would affect the alpha motor neuron in other ways. So anywhere along the path of the alpha motor neuron that it is affected, we can see areflexia or hyporeflexia. Diseases of the neuromuscular junction also, we might see hyporeflexia or areflexia in the patient. Now, if we have a disease of the muscle, well, then it's going to be hard for the muscle to contract and give the characteristic or stereotyped activity. And so, therefore, we can see hypo or areflexia in patients who have lesions of the muscle. A lesion of the peripheral nerve, in that instance, you're affecting the afferent and the efferent limb of the reflex. So we can see hypo or areflexia there. Additionally, we can see hypo or areflexia if we have a patient with injury to the afferent limb alone. So if everything else is working but we don't have the afferent limb of that reflex, well, then we cannot inform our central nervous system of the stretch that is occurring in the muscle to produce the resultant contraction. So as we know, hyperreflexia suggests an upper motor neuron lesion. It is also associated with clonus, and it could affect the corticospinal tract anyway along its path from the cortex to just before its synapses on the lower motor neuron. Spinal shock. So spinal shock, as we said, is seen with an acute injury, and it usually takes about 4 weeks thereabouts before spinal shock wears off. So at this point of the injury, we usually see we will see hyporeflexia, we would see flaccid paralysis because of the initial shock, so to speak, or the initial injury to the spinal cord. But after this time would have passed, if the patient has an injury to the upper motor neurons, well, then you will see the characteristic features of an upper motor neuron syndrome, which is your hyperreflexia, clonus, spasticity, and so on. So we're going to close up with a clinical correlation. We have a 62-year-old woman. She works as an accountant, and since 2 to 3 months, she's been having problems with walking. It's been so bad that she had to use a cane. Her muscles became stiff, so she's seeing that her muscles are seeming very stiff. So just based on that information, if you had to make a guess, what type of syndrome you think our patient is having in terms of motor neuron damage? Do you think it's a lower motor neuron damage or an upper motor neuron damage? Okay, I see some people pointing towards their head. All right, so it's indicating something in the upper motor neuron, all right, somewhere along the corticospinal tract, whether it's in the cortex or anywhere along its descent into the spinal cord. So, because we need to get more information on this patient, we'll need to do imaging studies and a neurological examination. So the neurological examination showed knee jerk and ankle jerk that were very brisk, okay? So I remember a student asked me a few days ago about very brisk reflexes. So if you may not see hyperreflexia, we may say very brisk reflex, and that would indicate hyperreflexia, okay? So very brisk reflex. She has bilateral extensor plantar response, so she has a Babinski, and the muscle tone in the legs is bilaterally elevated, as she would have said. Her legs is very stiff, and of course, all of this is pointing towards an upper motor neuron syndrome. All right, so an imaging study, we got an image of her spinal cord. Just much can be seen. So the patient's diagnosis was tropical spastic paraparesis, also known as TSP. And this is a chronic degenerative neurological lesion that causes demyelination of the spinal cord. And of course, it causes your characteristic upper motor neuron symptoms. Now, this is usually associated with patients who have been affected or infected with the HTLV-1 virus, okay? The virus can be spread, of course, through the placenta or other means of contamination. Persons who use needles, it can be due via sexual contact, breastfeeding, all right? So it's seen in a lot of tropical locations. So here in Grenada, HTLV-1 is very common, very prominent, all right? I know that in other places you might hear a lot about HIV being, you know, very prominent, but HTLV-1, we see that relatively frequent here in Grenada. Apart from the Caribbean, you can also see it in Japan, South America, Western Africa, and other regions. It usually affects adults between the ages of 30 and 40, and it's actually more common in women than men. And this TSP, I actually had a patient one time when I was doing my internship who had this particular lesion. And by that time, she wasn't able to walk, all right? Her symptoms were so advanced that walking was very difficult for that patient. So the disease, of course, is going to remain asymptomatic for many years. And when your immune system basically has been affected, for some reason it goes down for her. In this patient's case, while she was getting older, we know as we get older, our immune response usually decreases. Then it's when we start to see the characteristic signs and symptoms associated with this lesion. And as in this patient, we saw that her presenting symptoms were difficulty walking and the stiffness of the leg. So how can we diagnose it? We can use a blood test, of course. So we can use an MRI to see what's going on with the spinal cord and nerve conduction studies and electromyography. Now, this condition, like many other viral illnesses, it's not curable. But significant improvement is seen with the use of corticosteroids. It's important to assess these patients also for HIV and multiple sclerosis-related myelopathy, as they may produce similar symptoms as was seen in this patient. All right? And as I said, you need to think about HIV in these patients. So this man comes to the physician because he has difficulty moving his right arm. We do some reflex testing on him, and we recognize that it's plus one. What other findings are likely in this limb? So if we have a patient whose reflexes is plus one, well, then we're thinking that he most likely has hyporeflexia, which is associated with what type of motor neuron disease? Did somebody say upper? Oh, low motor neuron disease. So therefore, we have to look for a finding that is associated with a lower motor neuron disease. What about Babinski? So this is upper. This is your extensor plantar response. Clonus, is associated with upper motor neuron disease. Hypertonia, as we saw in the case with TSP, that's associated with an upper motor neuron disease. Spasticity, again, upper motor neuron. So atrophy is what we are left with, and you should know that atrophy is a classical finding of patients who have lower motor neuron disease. All right, so this is your last slide. Thank you for your attention.